Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Our Torah portion is Deuteronomy chapter 32. This is the Moses' song or poem. People debate whether you call it a song or call it a poem. It's arguable. Now, we're going to start this. We read this through this, but we're going to start out in the last verse of chapter 31, because that's what introduces his whole poem slash song that he's singing here. So start out the verse ahead. Verse previous, which is Deuteronomy 31, verse 30, and then we'll continue on to read the whole chapter 32, and then we'll discuss it. So starting in chapter 31, verse 30, it says, Moses spoke the words of this song into the ears of the entire congregation of Israel until their conclusion. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and may the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop like the rain. May my utterance flow like the dew, like storm winds upon vegetation, like raindrops upon blades of grass. When I call out the name of Jehovah, ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. Perfect is his work, for all his paths are justice. A God of faith without iniquity, righteous and fair is he. Corruption is not his. The blemish is his children's, a perverse and twisted generation. Is it to Jehovah that you do this, O vile and unwise people? I'm now in middle of verse 6 of chapter 32. Is he not your father, your master? Has he not created you and formed you? Remember the days of old. Understand the years of generations. Ask your father, and he will relate it to you. Your elders, they will tell you. When the Supreme One gave the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of man, he set the borders of the peoples, according to the number of the children of Israel. For Jehovah's portion is his people. Jacob is a measure of his inheritance. He discovered him in a desert land, in desolation, a howling wilderness. He encircled him. He granted him discernment. He preserved him like the pupil of his eye. He was like an eagle arousing its nest, hovering over its young, spreading its wings and taking them, carrying them on its pinions. Jehovah alone guided them, and no other power was with them. He would make him ride on the heights of the land, and have him eat the ripe fruits of my fields. He would suckle him with honey from a stone, and oil from a flint rock. Butter of cattle and milk of sheep with fat of lambs, rams born in Bashan and he-goats, with wheat as fat as kidneys. And you would drink the blood of grapes like delicious wine. Jeshurun became fat and kicked. You became fat, you became thick, you became corpulent, and it deserted God, its maker. Jeshurun was contemptuous of the rock of its salvation. They would provoke his jealousy with strangers. They would anger him with abominations. They would slaughter to spirits with no power, gods whom they did not know. Newcomers recently arrived from your ancestors, did not dread. You ignored the rock who gave birth to you and forgot God who brought you forth. Jehovah will see and be provoked by the anger of his sons and daughters, and he will say, I shall hide my face from them and see what their end will be, for they are a generation of reversals, children whose upbringing is not in them. They provoked me with a non-god. They angered me with their vanities. So I broke them with a non-people. With a vile nation, and I shall anger them. For fire will have been kindled in my nostrils and blazed to the lowest depths. It shall consume the earth and its produce, and set ablaze what is founded on the mountains. I shall accumulate evils against them. My arrows shall I use up against them. Bloating of famine, battles of flaming spirits, cutting down by the noontime spirit. And the teeth of beasts shall I dispatch against them, with the venom of those that creep on the earth. On the outside the sword will bereave, while the indoors there will be dread. Even a young man, even a virgin, even a suckling child with gray-haired man, I had said, I will scatter them. I will cause their memory to cease from man. Were it not that the anger of the enemy being pent up, lest his tormentors misinterpret, lest they say, our hand was raised in triumph. It was not Jehovah who accomplished all this. For they are a nation bereft of counsel. There is no discernment in them. Were they wise, they would comprehend this. They would discern it from their end. For how could one pursue 1,000, or 2 cause a myriad to flee, if not that their rock had sold them out, and Jehovah had delivered them? For not like our rock is their rock, yet our enemies judge us. For their vineyard is from the vineyard of Sodom, and the fields from Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, so clusters of bitterness were given to them. Serpent's venom is their wine, the poison of cruel their vipers. Is it not revealed with me, sealed in my treasuries? Mine is vengeance and retribution at the time their foot will falter. For the day of their catastrophe is near, and the future events are rushing at them. When Jehovah will have judged his people, he shall relent regarding his servants. When he sees that enemy power progresses and none is saved or assisted, he will say, where is their God? The rock in whom they sought refuge, the fat of whose offerings they would eat. They would drink the wine of their libations. Let them stand and help you. Let them be a shelter for you. See now, I am he, and no God is with me. I put death and I bring life. I struck down, I will heal. There is no rescuer from my hand. For I shall raise my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand grasps judgment, I shall return vengeance upon my enemies. Upon those that hate me shall I bring retribution. I shall intoxicate my arrows with blood, and my sword devour the flesh, because the blood of corpses in the captive. Because the earliest depreciations of the enemy. Sorry, depredation of the enemy. O nations, sing the praises of his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants. He will bring retribution upon his foes. He will appease his land and his people. Moses came and spoke all the words of this song in the ears of the people. He said to Joshua, son of Nun, Moses concluded speaking all these words to Israel. He said to them, apply your hearts to all the words that I testify against you today, with which you are to instruct your children, to be careful to perform all the words of this Torah. For it is not an empty thing for you, for it is your life. And through this matter shall you prolong your days on the land to which you cross the Jordan to possess it. Jehovah spoke to Moses on that very day, saying, ascend to this mountain of Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, which is before Jericho, and see the land of Canaan that I shall give to the children of Israel as an inheritance. And you will die on this mountain, where you will ascend and be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people. Because you trespassed against me on the children of Israel at the waters of strife at Kadesh, in the wilderness of Zin, because you did not sanctify me among the children of Israel. From a distance shall you see the land, but you shall not enter there, into the land that I give to the children of Israel. That was Deuteronomy chapter 32, our Song of Moses, so to speak. Before I go into my little spiel about this, any comments, questions, opinions about this particular song? It's such an uplifting song, isn't it? Any opinions? None at all? That's great. Found one. Oh, found two. Go ahead, Daniel.
I was just curious, how do you imagine that Moses read the Torah to all the people?
Okay. That's, go ahead. As far as physically, like how do you physically let them all hear it?
Well, we do have something from a historical reference to that. For example, the Gettysburg Address was read to everybody who was there, but not everybody could hear it. What they ended up having to do was, because Lincoln was somewhat soft-spoken, they would relay it back from person to person all the way back through the crowd.
That makes sense, like playing a telephone game. What did he say? He didn't say it. Yes, he did. Yes, Pierre Ann.
I wish they had obeyed what they were told.
Yeah, that would have helped. One thing I want to point out, it was interesting. It would have helped. Oh, yes, Rose, go ahead.
Psalm 90 and 100?
90 to 100? A lot of it is. I believe it's rewritten or re-recorded most of that as well. There is some, I think there's one, a few words different, but not much. It's very, very similar. I want to bring your attention before we go into Moses' spiel. Note that Moses instructed them that they will hear and teach their children this song. There's a phrase in here, it's put it to heart, which means you'll memorize it. Have you memorized a song before? Yeah, who hasn't, right? You put it to a music or a tune, it's really easy to memorize. I don't know the tune of this, so I can't sing it for you. But if there was a tune, it's easy to memorize. Because remember, we discussed this a few weeks, that the entire, at least Deuteronomy, but the entire Torah gets read out loud to all the people at Sukkot once every 7 years. So everybody who's there can hear it. Probably the relay method, I'm not sure, but you go through it, everybody gets to hear it once every 7 years. Well, what about, not everybody has a Bible. Nobody has a book or even 10 versions of it that we have now in multiple languages. Nobody had those. Had it read out loud. But this song was taught to a tune or a poem to be memorized. What was that? A cantor, yeah, to be memorized. So Ed would remember it throughout the year, not the entire, all the law of Moses, just this song, just this poem was memorized and taught to children so they know it by heart. That's the idea behind this message. In this particular chapter, I mean, you focus on it, the idea is to not forget what this one says. It means something to you. So I should go to that. Any other questions or comments so far? Okay. There's a few details about this we're going to go through. Hopefully not too complicated. Moses is pretty straightforward, but there's a few things that I want to bring to your attention. First of all, starting at verse 1. It says, of course, obviously heaven and earth bear witness. Why would heaven and earth bear witness? Because they outlive you and me, right? They're going to outlive it. They bear witness to all this. I want to bring your attention. So heaven and earth is what Moses is bringing, calling as a witness to them, which is similar to what Samuel did when his farewell address. That heaven and earth will watch and say, hey, watch with this because it will outlive you. I don't usually cover this, but talk about it anyway. Verse 3. Now, I know various Bibles word this in a whole lot of different ways and translate to English many different ways. But verse 3, the standard way of translating this to English, don't get wrong, I'm not going to, throw feathers out there, is that when I call the name of Jehovah, you ascribe greatness to God. I mean, the person who's hearing ascribes greatness to God. So when Moses is doing this, he's calling out the heaven and earth as a witness. So he's calling out the name of God. To call out the name of God is to ascribe greatness to him, as opposed to calling out some of the other name. If I say Rose, Well, that brings everybody's attention to hearing I said the word rose. They all bring their attention to you, right? Because I said your name. Same thing with God. If I call his name, everybody's, oh, I heard the name of this individual, or in this case, God. They all draw their attention to what about him? It says to lift that individual up. Well, that the people have to respond. To ascribe greatness is to elevate him up in a particular status, which is what Moses is doing here. So I want to bring out some things he says about him, which is the next verse. So God is, Moses is bringing him up and elevating him up. It says, the rock, perfect his work, for all his paths are justice, a God of faith without iniquity, righteous and fair is he. So when we address God, address his name, that's the idea Moses wants the memorization to be, because we're supposed to memorize this song, that perfect is his work, he's our rock, his paths are justice, and the God of faith, not iniquity, and righteous and fair is he. That's the idea. We're supposed to elevate him in those which we think about when we think about when we hear his name. It's these features, these components. I want to bring your attention to a few words in here, in this verse 4. Now, mind you, the word rock is being reused as a theme throughout this whole song. But the perfect of his work, what does perfect mean? Ah, see, those are two different definitions you just rattled off. She said complete, and you said without blemish. Those mean different things. See, without blemish means it is, in English, without any flaw. It's zero flaws. Complete means finished. Whether it has flaws or not, it's finished. The Hebrew term of perfect implies complete. So does the Greek word for perfect implies complete. We translate it as perfect, as if it has no flaws. So it says the rock with is complete is his work. There's a lot of things that you and I would say, God, that work there isn't so good. Did you really intend to make that? And we'll discuss some of those today. Yes, Daniel.
So that also implies a past, present, and perfect. Future works are complete because he's outside of space.
He's outside
and time.
Of time, right? There's no space and time with God. So beginning and end is already completed already. He's finished it. It's already been rewritten. Already has been written. We're just finding out what he wrote as we go to live through our lives. So the idea of complete. I would bring this attention because I know this upsets a lot of people, but I want you to think about it. It's not to convince you, but just think about it. So when God made the Garden of Eden, what one particular tree that we don't like that he put in it? What was it? Was it a little louder? Good and bad. Good and bad. So, all of his work is complete. He has no iniquity in him. Who made bad? God made bad. Hasatan is a deceiver, but God made it. God made good. God made bad. Who made evil? God made evil. Actually, he said he did, to be fair. He said, I made evil. I'm the one who made bad. He says so. He says, I did it. Nobody else did it. I made them. Yes, Larry.
He said that explicitly?
Yes. It's recorded multiple places. Let's see here. It's recorded in... Yes. Oh, crud. Did I write that verse down? See, I made false teachers. Is that Isaiah? See, God made all 45, 43, and is that Habakkuk? I think that might be it. Yes, God said he made them.
If he made good, then evil is possible because it's the opposite.
It's the opposite of it.
So you could make this thing and you can take credit or take responsibility for the fact that there's the other thing there, but he never intended for us to indulge in that.
He didn't say to make it to indulge in or to use to our use. who gets to use the bad? Only God uses it. He's the one who decides, hey, Joe Schmuley, Jimbo 7, you've done something incorrect. Here is a bad thing that comes upon you. What was that?
Does it? That would make it good, even though it
exactly
hurts the person.
Exactly. Exactly. That's correct. He's using it for our good, but he created it to begin with. Does that make sense? And that in the nature of making, so all of his work is complete. It's all finished. Even the stuff we don't like, he still designed and created it. It's an important thing to remember that God is not a, there isn't a duality here to where there's a good God and a bad God. It doesn't work that way. It's one. So remember that. It's always one that does everything. Nothing bad happens to us without his permission. Without, 45, thank you. 45, chapter 45, Isaiah 45, verse 7. Thank you. I knew it was 45, Isaiah 45, verse 7. I should have written it down. Let's read the first 7 verses. Might as well. Thus Jehovah said to his anointed one, this is into Cyrus' case, whose right hand I have grasped to subdue nations before him, that I might loosen the loins of kings, to open doors before him, and that gateways not be shut. I will go before you and straighten the twisting paths. I will smash copper doors and sever iron bolts. I will grant you the treasures of darkness, the hidden treasures of secret places, in order that you should know that I am Jehovah who has proclaimed your name. I, the God of Israel, for the sake of my servant Jacob and Israel, my chosen one, I have proclaimed you by name. I dubbed you, though you did not know me. I am Jehovah, and there is no other. Other than me, there is no God. I will gird you, though you did not know me, in order that those from the east and west would know that there is nothing besides me. I am Jehovah. There is no other. I am the one who forms light and creates darkness, who makes peace and creates evil. I am Jehovah, maker of all things. So he's the one who's addressing him. I do everything. It's important just to realize that our God, when we worship him and praise him, there is a component that tools he has that he corrects us with, right? Chastises, exactly. Those tools we as humans interpret as bad. Like, ouch, that hurt, right? We don't like hurting. It's good for us, but it still is it's like a swatting of the hand. Ouch. The only reason I realize I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't touch the hot pan, because a hot pan burns me. The negative consequence hurts me. God created those negative consequences, those negative things too. He built them both. He uses them both to his needs, his discretion. So when we read the book of Moses, Deuteronomy chapter 32, remember that this is the God that Moses is addressing. This is the God that Moses sees. Hey, everybody, you're going to do some really bad things. And look what God's going to do to you. You will provoke him with awful things you do to other fake gods, non-living things. Things that you will provoke him to his anger. And as a result, he's going to cause these negative consequences, which are very severe, against you, such that there is no one left to save. No one left to rescue, as is recorded in this chapter. No one's left till he's finished. It's a very hard thing to remember and think about, but that's who our God is. He wants great blessings to us, but when we fail, the chastising is hard. It's very hard, to the point of total destruction, nearly. He does stop himself. He does say, hey, there is a limit. But the point is, that's the type of nature we're dealing with. So this is the God that Moses wants all the people to memorize and remember during the intermediate 7 years, as they get to hear the rest of the Torah once every 7 years. The remaining 6 years, think about this particular God and focus on who he is and what he can do and what he has done. Does that make sense so far? So that's what I mean. God, he did good and bad. He created, he completed. Everything is complete. It's all one thing. You can't have one and divide them all out and separate out. Well, I'll only take the good stuff and you keep the bad stuff. It doesn't work that way. Okay, let's continue on now. So this is our God. Let's see here. Jump to verse. Obviously, this is a it's a poem, a song. So it's a play on words. So points out that God's pointing out that that these people, referring to the children of Israel, are vile and unwise people, and He's going to bring upon them vile and non-people. He's going to attack them with non-people because they worship non-gods. So the children of Israel have a non-God worshiping problem, the non-God worship. And God's going to return the non-God worship with non-God, not non-people. So not, they worship non-God, so they're going to be attacked by non-people. What is a non-people? Anybody have any idea what a non-people is? Oh, I know what a person is. You know, there's one, I'm one. Aliens? Are we outer space invaders? What was that? A godless person? That's a non-people, but it also calls the non-people a nation in this poem. So it's a nation of non-people. Now, we would normally think of Gentiles, because that is a mixture of a blender, so to speak, of lots of different blends of everything in the sun. But to get a non-people, a mixture of everybody, all on the same page to attack Israel, to destroy them, that's not easy to do. Yes, Jared?
Doesn't it also say that they're a nation of fools?
The nation of yes, it's referred into the verse, where is that? Verses, let's see, jealousy, nation, abomination, slaughter demons. Well, he points out that the children of Israel are also a nation of field. The nation of reversals, that's who they are. And they put it on God, in their vanities. Verse, was it 21. They provoked me with a non-God, angry with their vanities. So I'll provoke them with a non-people, with a vile nation, I shall anger them. So much like God calls them a vile people, calls children of Israel a vile people, which is a disgusting or a foolish people, but also the nation that's going to be brought forward, the non-people, will also be a disgusting or foolish nation. I want to bring this to you, this non-people, because it's reused twice in our Tanakh. This example, this poem of Moses. We won't go through all of them, but one of them is the first time is when Babylon comes and destroys Israel. Much of this poem is recited in that event. Isaiah records that. And it's also recorded again with, as we just read, with Cyrus. It's recorded at that time too. When they came through it, so just before Cyrus, they came through and destroyed. It's recorded again when Romans come along, because there's re-recorded New Testament. The idea is that these destructive powers are coming through to destroy and cause this type of event, this destructive event. Now, when he says we're going to destroy you, there's no one left. That is in verse 36, I believe it is. There it is. Verse 36 says, when Jehovah will have judged his people, he should relent regarding his servants. When he sees the enemy power progresses and none is saved or left to assist. So there's no one left of the people of Israel to save. No one left to assist. That's when God says, oh, good enough. We did it. That's depressing, isn't it? What was that? Are we at that time, like modern day history? I won't speak to modern day. We're discussing what this poem is. The poems we memorize forever. So I would suspect it's probably throughout a generational thing to pay attention to, because it can happen at any point in time. But the idea is that this poem is supposed to be memorized, so we remember these things and think this is the kind of God we have, kind of God we worship, kind of God that we fear. Not just worship, we actually fear him too, because we fear that we screw up enough. He says, I'm done with you. We don't want that. We don't want, I don't want to scoop it up to where he says, you know what, Daniel, you're finished. I'll move on to somebody else. That's a place we don't want to be, right? So we have to maintain that. So memorize it that you will remember all your days. This is the type of God you have. If you go too far, if you provoke him too much, you don't want him to say, I'm done with you. Because that's what you're telling that these people about. He provoked them too much. Let's go back a little bit, because I want to discuss a few details about some of the word choices in your Bibles, because they're fascinating to me. In the rock. Wrote God, they're hiding his face. He hides his face from us. This whole process, by the way, this whole destruction, what's happening to them and such, is a hiding of his face. God's not actually actively saving anybody. From verse 20, it says, I will hide my face from them and see what their end will be, for they are a generation of reversals. A judge's upbringing is not in them. And it goes through the whole process, all the way through, about he's concealed his face from them. So all these difficulties, the nation, verse 20, when he jumps all the way through to verse 28, refers that they're a nation, they have no counsel. There is no discernment in them. Were they wise, they would comprehend this and they would discern from their end. They would see what's happening to them. They would see the fact that their rock, their God, has sold them off, has gotten rid of them. They would see the world around us, wait a minute, this isn't what it's supposed to be. This wasn't supposed to happen this way. If they have counsel or thought or comprehension in them, they would recognize and say, hey, something has gone wrong. They would only recognize that if they memorized the poem. Else they'll forget it and not pay attention. Because there is a nature, a problem with human beings. We all have this problem. Let's go back to verse 15. What is the problem that all humans have? Verse 15, Jeshurun, which means the righteous people, became fat and kicked. You became fat, you became thick, you became corpulent, you deserted God, its maker. Contemptuous of the rock of its salvation. What does affluence cause in humans? What was that? Pride? Yeah, we have everything. Affluence means you fear loss of nothing. There's nothing you could possibly lose because you have everything. You have abundance of it. That's what destroys us. Destroys me. Destroys all of us. The nature of struggle forces us to actually work for something and maintain it, right? Anybody have ever raised a plant before, ever in your life, right? If the plant is abundantly watered, what happens to it? Usually it dies. Why? It's too much. It's not growing properly. It's not struggling properly. If you have to abundantly water it continually, in order to keep it survive, any struggles come along, immediately dies. Plants need struggle to be strong. That's how propagation works. The same principle. You have a little bit, you have to work for it in many ways. There's a reason we live in a grape mass-producing region. Why? Well, what do they do with those grapes? They make the plants struggle. They put them on hillsides and give them a little bit of water, but not too much. Just a little bit, make them work for it. And what does it produce? Good grapes. The plants have to struggle for it. So having an abundance of affluence sounds great, sounds wonderful. What does it produce in us? Lazy, selfish, self-interested people. Fat. We get fat, which in biblical terms means non-responsive. You don't notice anything. The idea of being fat is you push on it and you shove around, it doesn't do anything. It's just fat. Well, that's it. You're not responding anymore. That's your fat, what it means to be to not respond. You cannot detect when things are happening anymore. That's the nature of fat. Biblical nature, sorry, not deferring to biological. We're just doing biblical definitions. Louise.
Greed. Affluence. Greed.
It does. Because you always want more, too. You always want more. There's never have enough. So these are the nature which God's dealing with. This is the kind of nature he's having to battle. He gave them all these great things. But it ruined them at the same time. So he's battling this type of individual. So he has to hide his face in order to bring them back. And his correction or his stress he puts upon them, what is that type of stress? Destruction. It's evil. Arrows. A bloating famine. Battles all the time. Inside and outside. All this stuff is destruction. That's how he brings back adversity, difficulty, stress, hard things, makes them worth something again. Let's see one. He goes through this, and one I want to bring to this. I find this funny. You may not. In verse 30, It says after verse 21, it says, if they were wise who comprehend this, they would discern from it and they would discern their end. For how could one person pursue 1,000 and two cause a myriad to flee if their rock had not sold them out and Jehovah had delivered them? Verse 31, for not like our rock is their rock, yet our enemies judge us. That is an interesting phrase because we're not sure who's speaking, whose rock is what rock in that. But in the whole time which God is ignoring them and watching them destroyed, this person saying their rock is not like our rock, it's most likely the people. Israel is realizing this. Our rock should be better than this, but yet our enemies judge over us. They rule over us. Our God's supposed to be stronger, but yet we're weaker. These are things that should be able to discern, to see. We have failed. We're low. What happened to us? And it continues on, of course, that this is the people of Israel referring to them. The Israelites' vineyards are from the vineyard of Sodom, and their fields are from Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, and cluster of bitterness we give to them. And venom's serpent, of course, serpent's venom is their wine and poison, their vipers. This whole idea is that they finally realize our destruction is caused, but our God is supposed to be bigger than this. Light bulbs start clicking on because you should have memorized the poem. That's the idea. Light bulbs are coming on. Oh, now we're seeing. Now we're understanding what has happened. And of course, we jump through a little bit further because there's something else I want to talk about today. I'm just going through this rather surface appearance only because I'm not going too deep on something else I'm going to get to. Of course, what is God's response once they see it? Let's jump to verse 37. This is God's response. Once they realize what's happened, realize their God is supposed to be greater, God responds. He says, where is your God? Where is he? Where is the rock that you trusted in? The one who's the fat offerings that would eat your fat offerings and the one that would drink your wine drinks. Where is he? I'm waiting. I've been watching this whole time. Now you realize what we're wrong. So now go out, call out to him. Go ahead. I'm waiting. How many gods are there, by the way?
One.
So what's God telling them? Call out to that thing, whatever it was, that demon, the angel, the spirit, whatever you thought it was, whatever you worshipped, go call out to it. He's still watching. It's like a theater. He's sitting back and watching. So, yep, I'm waiting for this, for you, for your main attraction. Come on, like the prophets of Baal with Elijah, same thing. I'm waiting. Bring him down. He's mocking them. Does God mock people? Yes. Yes, God mocks people. He does have a mocking sense of humor, and this is it. It's quite clear. Where are they? Because you want verse 38, the latter half. Says, let them stand and help you. Let them be a shelter for you. And then verse 39 says, do you see now? It's me. There is no other God. It's just me alone. There's not 10, 20, 30, 5, 3, 8. No, it's just me. Just I'm alone. I'm the only person who can save you. Yes.
It's kind of like Dr. Phil says, and how's that working for you?
Yeah, how's that working for you? Same idea. God points out that I'm the one who puts to death. I bring life. I strike down. I heal. There's no rescuer from my hand. No one will deliver you from my hand. Because there isn't God that you can call upon. You offer all these gods. I have this God and that God of this. And mind you, we think, we don't worship gods, right? I don't have idols in my house. Most of you probably don't either. I don't think any of you do. But we still have lots of gods. Keep in mind, we have a lot of gods. Lots of them. Each one of us have lots of gods. Most of us are gods are ourselves. But sometimes are gods, the things we have. We trust in them. But that's what you're doing. You're trusting in either what you have, what you can do, what you think you know. You really don't know anything. We think we know. We really don't. Money is one of the things that we got. Our resources, which is exactly what Jeshurun has. He just said earlier, hey, you grew fat. You grew affluent. Lots and lots of stuff. You trusted in those things. So trust in them now. They don't save you. There's only one God that saves. There's only one God at all. And lastly, there's no rescue from my hand. The latter half of verse 39, sorry. No rescue from my hand. There's no one who will take you out of my hand. So God said, he said, I've got you. I watched all this destruction. You're not getting free. You can call all you want to any God you offered, all your resources, all your intelligence, all your whatever you have. You can't get out of my hand. That's it. Because there's only one God there. For I raise my hand to heaven and say, as I live forever, if I sharpen my, this is verse 41, if I sharpen my sword, my hand grasps judgment, I'll return vengeance upon my enemies, upon those that hate me, I shall be retribution. That is inclusive. Oh, yes, go ahead.
You know, that is really, and we use the phrase a double-edged sword, because if we're living in righteousness, we feel comfortable in God's hand.
Right.
But if we're living in iniquity and rebellion, then being in his hand
crushes.
Is not a good thing. Doesn't feel too good.
Right, it doesn't. It is a double-edged sword. He says, hey, I sharpen my flashing sword right here, verse 41. My hand grasps judgment, I shall return vengeance upon my enemies. His enemies are more than just outside nations coming and attacking his people. His own people are also included in those enemies. The ones who reject and provoked him to anger. Does your enemy provoke you to anger? Yes, that's what we call them enemies. I don't like them. They're making me angry because of what they're doing. His own people did. So he even judges his own people because they are still, not everybody, not every human being. The point is, the nation as a whole are his enemies also. We are an enmity with God all the time. We're human. Yes, Anne.
It almost sounds like that everyone can be saved then, because he's holding everyone.
He does. Everyone has that option, that choice, that point. I believe it's Micah who says so. I could be wrong on that. He points out that all the people will come and they will all have, there's only one God. We all have the same God. I mean, the people didn't like that. But Micah still is pointing that out. The people rejected his message, but that was the idea, that there isn't multiple options. There's one, and there isn't, oh, well, I have my God, you have yours, of, you know, the Babylonians have their. No. There's only one there, and it's only one option. Make sense? Hopefully it does. Okay, any other questions about this Torah portion? Because I'm going to go to something slightly different than this. Let's see. We jump to, before we leave this chapter, because we go to two other locations. The tail of this chapter, there's one thing I want to bring to your attention so we don't forget, that Moses points out. It's a verse 47, I think it is. There it is. For it is not empty. He wants you to memorize this whole song, apply all these things. It's going to happen to you. It's not an empty thing for you. It is your life. Now, there used to be, was it a game show, This Is Your Life? Or a long time ago, right? To bring back people from old. This is what he's doing. This poem, this song, is your life. Not like, oh, well, I like verse, you know, 1 through 6, and I'll skip, you know, verse 18. No, the whole thing is your life. The whole unit, because God's works are complete. Everything is finished. Enjoy. It's yours now. The whole thing, the good and the bad, it's all yours. It all is your life. But this is your life. Remember, this is your life. And through this matter, you shall prolong your days, the land which you cross the Jordan to possess it. So when you receive God, you receive him, he comes as a complete unit. You don't get just the good parts and the difficulties get thrown out the window. They all come as a unit together. The whole thing is our life. It comes together. Okay, let's jump to something a little bit. It's on the same thread of what we're discussing, but slightly different. I'm going to jump to two of the places. The first place we go to is in part of what God's saying here in this part is in Isaiah 43. So Isaiah 43, read a few verses. It's almost like a repetition of part of this, but the point is, in Isaiah's chapter 43, he's discussing this song. He brings up on purpose because that's the time which the people of Judah are living through. Chapter 43, starting in verse 10. You are my witness, the word of Jehovah, my servant whom I have chosen, so that you will know and believe in me and understand that I am he. Before me, nothing was created by a God, nor will there be after me. I, only I, am Jehovah. There is no deliverer aside from me. I have foretold and brought salvation and informed you. There was no strange God in your midst. You are my witness, the word of Jehovah, and I am God. Even before there was a day, I was he. There is none who can save from my hand. When I act, who can reverse it? Thus says Jehovah your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, because of you I sent him, referring to Israel, to Babylon, and took down all their bolted gates and the Chaldeans and boats amid their shouting, I am Jehovah your God, the Holy One, Creator of Israel, your King. So he's pointing out here in this instance that he does everything, everything is his, it's all within his mastery. So we all focus on not just in Israel, what's he pointing out? It goes beyond, as Anne had pointed out, the Gentile nations. They have the same God that we do. They have the same consequences that we have. Because there's only one God. That's it. There's not 10, 20, or 30. It's only one. So if he affects us, or me, or you, he affects them, those, and their places. Same idea, the same process, same God. So in this God, there is a, for lack of a better term, a concept of action, of responsibility on the people's part, right? So when we read that the Jeshurun, the righteous ones, got fat because they got, and they kicked, and they rebelled, and went against, and provoked, what does all that mean? How do I not get fat? How do I not provoke God? How do I not kick him? How do I not reject him? Let's go to Ezekiel. This is Ezekiel chapter 18, one of my preferred chapters. I happen to like this chapter because it's one of the few chapters that points out, it corrects the philosophy the King David had, because King David made a mistake, not just with Uriah and Bathsheba, but with the killing off of Saul's descendants. Because I had previously interpreted David's action of killing off Saul's descendants as righteous. And I, Daniel, personally, have learned that was an error in my thinking. I didn't understand what was being written in King David's time. Well, Ezekiel 18 explains what was happening at King David's time, because King David, we think of a man after God's own heart, as it's recorded. One who desires and follows God, a righteous, holy king. Well, not perfect, obviously, but still a righteous king. Well, Ezekiel 18 discusses this. This is an important thing to remember, because if I don't want to provoke God, I don't want to offend him, I don't want to be the recipient, not to say my nation won't be, referring to me only, or you as individuals, we can't control others, but just ourselves. Ezekiel 18 helps explain this. So Ezekiel 18, so the word of Jehovah came to me, this is Ezekiel, referring to, why do you relate this parable upon the land of Israel, saying the fathers eat sour grapes, but the teeth of the sons are set on edge? As I live, the word of Jehovah Elohim, I swear that there will be no longer anyone among you who uses this parable in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine. Like the soul of the Father, so the soul of the Son, they are mine. The soul that sins shall die. We'll stop there for a minute. We'll keep reading in a minute. So the parable, what does that parable mean? The fathers eat sour grapes, and the sons are on edge. Say a little louder there, Larry. Right. The sins of the fathers being passed on to the sons. This is what the fear of it, which we discussed this not too long ago. The same concept. The idea that the fathers did something wrong, and now the sons are, since he did the wrong, what's God going to do against me? That we just read about, that the sons theoretically should have memorized Moses chapter 32, the song. Yes, Fear Ann.
It's the sins of the father and the sons have the consequences of those.
Which is a different philosophy. It's an important thing to remember. Those are distinct things. The idea that the sons are going to receive the correction or a consequence. They are different. They are different. You're absolutely right. But this is the theory that the consequence, which he's pointing out here, God says you will no longer use this parable. So the idea is you will not be, what he had pointed out, the idea of that the sins are now mine because my dad did something wrong. We may have consequence, but the sin isn't mine. Because God points out, I will pay the one who has sinned. But your answer is absolutely correct, which is really what happens, really in real life. The children still have consequence of what the parents did, but it's not, the sin isn't paid upon them. In this parable, what, do you recall what King David did? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. There was, I believe it was a famine. I could be wrong there. I think it was a famine at the time. And David was trying to figure out, God, what went wrong? And he inquires and asks around and gets people's advice. Say, well, King Saul killed a number of God's people back when he was hunting David earlier. He was a town of Nod, I think it was what it was called. He went to a bunch of people out, a bunch of priests. And David inquires, finds out the concubines that Saul had and its descendants. And he goes off and he hangs all those descendants as payment for the death of the priests. And as the story goes on, it says, oh, well, and then God relented and the plague, whatever it was, ended. And I had always interpreted that as being David was correct to punish Saul's sons as a result of what Saul did, because there was a consequence, David addressed it, and then there was a benefit. Not understanding God, myself, I didn't understand what God was doing. It had nothing to do with David's execution of Saul's sons, that why God relented. It was wrong move, David. I'm pulling back my play, but that was the wrong move. We have the same or a similar story recorded when King Jehoshaphat goes and attacks a Moab. And the Edoms are with him. And the Moab king offers the king of Edom's son burns him up on the wall alive as an offering during the middle of the battle. And then all the people of Israel and the people of Edom back away and end and walk away from the battle. They leave Moab alone. And I had interpreted, well, that's a strange reaction. It's because they were so abhorred by what they just saw. Said, you just burned our friend's son on the wall in front of us alive. I'm too disgusted to continue on fighting against you. That's what actually happened. So in this instance, when David had done this, God was so disgusted, I'm not going to address, it's just going to get worse from here. And I understand that because Ezekiel, that's what he's explaining in Ezekiel 18. That you get so disgusted, this is disgusting, I'm going to back off and watch and just, I'm going to leave this alone, it's too gross for me. So this is the point that this parable will end, this idea that the sons be paid for the fathers. Because I don't want chapter 32, the consequence, to fall upon me. I just don't. I don't want to provoke my God. Let's continue on in chapter 18, verse 5. If a man is righteous and practices justice and righteousness, he does not partake of idolatrous sacrifices upon the mountains. He does not lift his eyes toward the idols of the house of Israel, does not defile his neighbor's wife or approach an impure woman, does not oppress any man who returns collateral for a debt, does not rob or any loot, gives his bread to the hungry, covers the naked with his clothing, does not give loans with usury or take interest, withholds his hand from corruption, executes true justice between man and man, goes according to my decrees and observes my ordinances to practice truth, he is a righteous man. He shall surely live. The word of Jehovah. So does that describe a person who provokes God or who follows God? Follows God. Verse 19. If he begets a violent son who sheds blood, who does any of these sins to his brother, who does not do all these good deeds, for he even partakes of idolatrous sacrifice by the mountains, defiles his neighbor's wife, oppresses the poor and the needy, robs, loot, does not return collateral, lifts his eyes toward the idols, commits abomination, gives loans with usury, and takes interest. Should he live, shall he not live? He shall not live. He has committed all these abominations. He shall surely die. His blood will be upon himself. So we have two examples of a righteous individual and an unrighteous individual. Very opposite. They're literally opposites of each other, as how it's written. So one is the father, one's the son. Does anyone pay other than the person who's guilty? No. The son pays, the father does not. Or the versus vice versa makes no difference. The one who's guilty pays, one who's not guilty does not. This is not referring to a nation, it's referring to individuals. So I cannot fix Moses' chapter 32 for a nation. I can't say, okay, nation, everybody, let's no longer be obstinate. Let's no longer be fat. Let's no longer be provoking our God. I can't do that. I'm one person. But I can as an individual do that. I can as an individual not provoke God to be a righteous individual. And well, let's go back a little bit to verse 9 again. It says, a righteous man, the list we just read off, the righteous man, all these good things he did, he shall surely live. Because what does a righteous man live by? By his faith. A righteous man lives by his faith. What does faith bind you? What does it mean? It doesn't mean belief, it means trust. You are fully trustworthy. Let's imagine for a moment. You had a person that you knew not very well, but you knew of them. You've met them once or twice. Say, so, oh, hey, what's your name again? Well, I'm making one up. Joe Schmooley. Schmooley, here's $5 million. You know, go do something good with it. How much faith do I have in Schmooley? Enough to give you $5 million, right? I have to have... I'm not asking for receipts. I'm not asking for what did you do? Just go to the good with it. That's trust in this individual. He's not going to go corrupt, do evil things, do something good with it. That, I have to trust this person. That's the type of faith, what faith means. To trust without concern. Just truly give it. It's fine. It truly trust in them. So it points out in our Torah portion that God had He has faith. He is faithful. He's full of fair in his faith. That means he is fully trustworthy. There's complete freedom in saying, it's yours. He won't make mistakes. I pray that a number of times. I know that God does not make mistakes. That's the kind of faith this person is, and that's the faith that a righteous man lives by. Abraham was the man lived by faith, right? So this is what he lives by. He lives by this trust, this complete trust of God. Let's go back down as we had read the father, the violent son, the righteous grandson. So this is an example of going through a generational thing in verse 14. If this violent son then begets a son who sees all the sin of his father that he had done and sees but does not do or act like them, he does not partake in the idolatrous sacrifice for the mountains, does not lift his eyes toward the idols of the house of Israel, does not defile his neighbor's wife, does not oppress any man, does not keep collateral, does not rob any loot, gives his bread to hungry, and covers the naked with clothing, withholds his hand from harming the poor, does not take usury or interest, obeys my ordinances, follows my decrees, he shall not die for his father's iniquity, he shall surely live. So we have the example of the dad was righteous, the son was evil, the grandson's righteous. And what does God do? The son who was evil, he's the one who pays. This one who destroys what God's name is, who takes it down and ruins it, that's when God's focused on sinning. That's what he's going to address. So as a nation with which Moses is talking about in chapter 32, the same principle applies. Let's pretend again. Ready? I have generation number 9. Who is generally, as a nation, righteous. I have generation number 10 that comes after you. As a nation, is unrighteous. Then I have generation number 11. The nation returns to righteousness. Which generation does God say, I'm getting rid of? The middle one, the one that was unrighteous. So this application that we hear has individuals can also apply to a nation. How do we know that? Read the Minor Prophets. They say it again and again and again and again and again. That's what they're telling us. We have generations that are evil, not just individuals. The Minor Prophets are about generations, whole sections of time. Generations has to be rejected. The whole generation is corrupt, must be destroyed. Daniel reiterates that. Jeremiah reiterates that. They say the same thing. The whole generation is to be wiped out. But then their children or grandchildren are righteous. Now it's time to bring you back. The same principle can apply to individual or as a nation. So Moses' warning and Ezekiel confirmation of how life works applies. It is, as Moses says, this is your life. Which generation are you in? Which rock do you choose? As an individual or as a nation or community or a family, makes a difference. What is the rock? Do you trust the one that God says, I'm going to sit back and watch because it wasn't me? Or the one says, yeah, that is me. That's, everyone makes those decisions. We all do, right? We all have to make decisions continuously because God's decisions are always complete. He has everything done. It's ready to go. He has the good for a good generation. He also has the bad for the bad generation. The good for the good person, the bad for the bad person. He has them both. They're both his. He controls them both. He says in Ezekiel 18, the one who sins against me, he shall not live. He is the one who gets destroyed. That individual, that focus, that purpose, that person. Yes, Larry.
I've always been kind of confused when Messiah said it is an evil and perverse generation that asks for a sign, and they're asking for a sign, and no sign will be given. Is that maybe why he said, I'm just not going to do it because you're an evil and perverse generation.
Right. You reject it anyway. You reject it anyway. As God had done, he did many good things for them. Have you ever tried to get honey out of a rock? If you successfully do so, let me know. I'd like to know. I can get water out of this. This is honey. Okay. And God, I gave you these great things, these impossible gifts, and you still didn't accept it. You still didn't accept me. You still didn't follow me. You still wasn't good enough. So why am I going to waste my effort? I'll give you even more when you're still not going to do it. It will do you no good. It is a waste effort. The generations before Messiah, not all of them, mind you, but some of them followed him, even though they didn't know him. They still followed. They followed his principles, his way of life. Many people did. They didn't have the miracles, though. They just did. They didn't need the miracle to prove it. The fact they existed was enough for them. Go ahead.
No, but the guy with the fish.
Jonah. That alone. That alone was enough to convince the nation or the city state of Nineveh. This man got spit out of a fish. And we believe him. And so we've repented. Now, they didn't experience it. They just, I'm assuming maybe someone saw the fish spit him out. I don't know. But somehow the word got out that, to say this would tell, something had to relay the information, but they accepted it. That was sufficient. They didn't experience it. They didn't even see it necessarily, but they accepted it. That's a big deal. That was enough. What was that? They could smell it. He may have stunk a bit. I don't know. Yes.
Well, it's like what Jesus said to Thomas when Thomas had been saying, I'm not going to believe until I see him for myself. And so Yeshua, you know, comes up and Thomas is able to touch him and everything. And then Yeshua says, blessed are those who will never see this, but yet believe anyway.
Right.
Because that's more of a blessing to believe without seeing than what Thomas, because we would think, oh, he was blessed. He got to touch the Messiah. But Messiah says no. In a lot of ways, the future generations who will only believe because of your word are going to be more blessed than you.
Yeah. They're more honorable, more righteous than you in that respect. So I want to make sure we understand this. So God has a set of tools or paths he uses as recorded to memorize his song, that he is great, he gives all these great things, but to not become thick and fat as a result of them. And when you do, and you get to calamities come, destruction comes, understand and pay attention to what happened, why is this happening? When you realize why it's happening, and you realize my tools aren't going to save me, my gods, my whatever it is that I depend on, aren't going to save me, that's when God's saying, oh yeah, Now you realize I'm still in charge. And so we realize that God is the only God, regardless of how much stuff we have or don't have. He's still the God in charge. He's still the one who decides, I save you or I destroy you. So now we choose, all right, I have my options, all my gods, things I once trusted in. Now I realize there's only one God to focus on. It's not my stuff. It doesn't save me. What do I do about it? What I do about it, Ezekiel 18 discusses this quite extensively. Righteous live by their faith, their trustworthiness on these things. And there's more to it than just what's being put in Ezekiel, but the trustworthiness of the righteous, that's how they live. And that's how God avoids that individual's destruction. It doesn't matter if you're a person, a family, or a nation, or a generation. It's all the same. The rules still apply. The sequence still applies. It's a decision that we make as individuals. Does that make sense? Any questions? So the idea is to, I'm not commanding you to memorize this, but the idea is of Moses was to memorize this song. If I had a tune, it might help, but I don't have one. And it probably sounds better in Hebrew than it does in English. Maybe it rhymes better. But either way, the idea is to memorize the idea of what's happening here in the intermediate days of our lives, that this is how it works, that pay attention to what we're doing, and that's how we live versus die. Any questions or comments? Opinions? Yeah, the devil didn't make you do it. Sorry. I took you over time. I apologize. Oh, yes, Larry? Yeah. Go ahead.
There was a... One of the things I read online about this was there... The apostolic Haftarah,
yes,
was in Romans 11,
yep,
verses 5 and 6.
Mm-hmm.
I can't figure out how to explain that.
Oh,
but I can talk to you about it later.
Yeah, we'll talk later about it. Sorry, yeah. I didn't cover that today, but that is the Haftarah portion, part of it at least. There's two or three Haftarah portions for this in the New Testament. Any questions or comments? Let's close with prayer. Almighty God, our Heavenly Father, thank you for the Shabbat, a day of rest. Father, thank you for your kindness and protection upon us, Father. Please help us to prepare for the coming Sukkot, our time of celebration with you, to dwell with you, Father. May you bless us and keep us safe. May you give us good company today, Father, as we share with one another our lives, our experiences, the life we have around us, Father, what you've done for us, how you've helped us, that we not become fat and thick, that rather we become responsive and focus on you, Father, to follow you, to know that you are our rock and there is no one else to trust in. We praise you, ask your blessing the rest of our Shabbat, Father, in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.